Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to November's collaboration episode. As always, my name is Zach Twomley, and as always, you are listening to When Diplomacy Fails. Now, you might be wondering, looking at the title of this collaboration episode, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't recognise Norman Oler's name, he's not a podcaster, what even is Blitzed? Well, history friend, I can tell you right now you're in for a treat, because Norman Oler, if you weren't aware, if you haven't been keeping up with the developing literature on drugs in Germany and drugs in Hitler's inner circle, etc., Norman Oler is the author of a book called Blitzed, and Blitzed looked at the subject of drugs in Germany before the Second World War and also during it, and also the drugs that Adolf Hitler and his inner circle were known to be taking. It's a very, very interesting book. It sheds incredible new light on a whole range of different topics. And Norman Oler was kind enough and generous enough with his time to talk to me, this best-selling author with his own Wikipedia page and a very high public profile at the moment. Norman Oler was generous enough to take some time to talk to me about his book. He takes us through the subjects that Blitzed addresses, and he becomes our guide, really, for the state of drug use in Germany during the Weimar Republic and during the outbreak of the Second World War. He brings us through what Hitler was doing, why he was taking these drugs, the extent to which Morell had access to Hitler, and really the kind of underrated fact that in at least from 1941 onwards, Hitler saw Theodor Morell more than any other person, which even in itself really does suggest that we should really pay more attention to Theodor Morell. And thankfully, that is exactly what Norman Oler does, and much of his book is actually based upon the notes that Theodor Morell provides. So you might be thinking to yourself, well, I don't really know what all this is. I'm not really that interested in drugs in the Third Reich. And hey, that's fine, but I would recommend that you listen up, because if you have an open mind and you're not of the kind of school of thought that says, this is the way the Second World War was, this is the way Nazi Germany was, and this is what Hitler is, then I would say, listen here, read Norman Oler's very accessible, very readable, and really very fascinating book. And yeah, open your mind to what's out there, because really, this is not some conspiracy quack book, no matter what one historian in particular says about it, and we do get into that. It's a critically acclaimed book. It's been very widely praised across the historical spectrum and in the different media outlets across the world. It's been translated into several languages, and it's an internationally best-selling book. I mean, what else do you want me to tell you? It's a very, very good book. I've read it twice myself, and I really can't praise the book enough for the new perspective it's given us on Nazi Germany, the Nazis, their ideology, their hypocrisies, and of course Adolf Hitler himself. Anything that brings us closer to understanding the person of Adolf Hitler is, in my view, a good thing. Some people don't like it. Some people don't like the fact that Norman Oler is a journalist by trade and he came in and did this historical book. But in fairness to Norman Oler, he spent a very long time in the archives looking at things in those archives that people have really not touched at all. And as he'll tell you himself, there's still boxes of documents in these archives that have yet to be touched, and maybe such stunning revelations, such as the ones outlined in Blitzed, are just waiting to be discovered by someone else who might just wander into these archives. Someday, perhaps, that might be me, but until then, I would encourage you guys to listen up to this collaboration episode, and maybe check out, in the links in the description of this episode, Norman Oler's book and Norman Oler's website, and hey, maybe even throw him a thanks and say you enjoyed listening to him on this podcast, because again, a huge thanks to Norman Oler for joining us, because it really, really helped me out and I really appreciate it. He's a very busy man. He's going all across the world to talk about his book and get the word of this new stuff out there, and it's really, really exciting to see like new ideas and new discoveries on a period of history that people think is oversaturated by all these. I mean, like, how many different books are on the Second World War, and yet here's a fresh take on a very old subject, and it really does give people like me hope that even in the long distant future I'll be able to do the same thing. So thanks to Norman Oler for furthering the cause of history, but especially for coming on to When Diplomacy Fails and maybe sending a bit of publicity about his book that way. If you're only here because you've never heard of When Diplomacy Fails before and you've only heard of Norman Oler, then thanks for stopping by. I hope you'll listen to this collaboration episode, which is an interview between myself and Norman Oler, and maybe check out some of our older stuff in the back catalogue. But until then, Any other information is in the description of this episode. I'm just gonna let it all go ahead and let the conversation between the two of us speak for itself. Without any further ado then, let's get into this. The next voices you hear will be mine and Norman Oler's. Thanks and enjoy. Norman Oler, thank you very much for joining us on When Diplomacy Fails podcast. And just in case people don't know, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Well, I'm from a small town in West Germany, but I live in Berlin now. I'm a novelist, and I also wrote one nonfiction book, and that is the book I suppose we might be talking about today. It's called Blitzed, Drugs in Nazi Germany.
Well, you just mentioned other books briefly there. I mean, I'm always interested to find out how people started their careers in journalism or in researching history or anything like that. So maybe just tell us a little bit about the books that happened before Blitz.
Well, I attended the Hamburg School of Journalism when I was quite young and was trained in writing journalistic texts. But the thing I really wanted to write was books, was fictional books. And I, in a way, fled Germany in the mid-90s and went to New York and wrote my first novel there, which was a detective story set in New York City, and then returned to Berlin to write my second book there. It's called Mitte Center. It's a ghost story set in Berlin. And then I lived for quite some time in Johannesburg, South Africa, and wrote my third novel there. It's called, the English translation is called Ponte City, and it's the story of a young girl from Soweto who moves into Johannesburg after apartheid falls, in order to find her luck, I suppose.
Cool. Okay. And when it comes to writing about history, how did you get drawn into doing that from doing fiction?
Well, my fourth novel, which just came out in Germany a few weeks ago, was actually the first project that's a history project. It's set in the 18th century, and it's about Frederick the Great's attempt to drain all the swamps of Prussia and turn them into farmland and thus develop Prussia into a modern economy. And when I started writing that book, for the first time, I did historic research, which then later on helped me to do Blitzed, which is heavily based on research in archives in Germany and the United States.
I'd love to know, if you could explain, say, because Blitzed does cover, like, you could, on the one hand, you could say that Blitzed is very kind of specific. It fulfills a specific niche in the historical market. But on the other hand, there is a lot going on in the book. So say you could summarize it into maybe a few sentences for people that don't know what Blitzed is all about. What kind of way would you put it?
On the one hand, it gives a comprehensive picture on how drugs were abused or used in Nazi Germany on a mass scale in civilian society, in the army. The German army used it to its advantage to invade Poland, France, Holland, kind of designed the Blitzkrieg with the help of methamphetamine. Also, it talks about extensively about the drug career of the Führer of Germany, of Hitler himself, who is shown to be, to the outside world, to be a teetotaler, but in fact he's using quite a lot of different medications, and towards 43 and 44 turns to using opiates. And so that stuff is very interesting. The facts are very interesting.
I feel like the story gives more than just a window into drug use and and Hitler's drug use. I feel like it gives a good account of the German psyche and how full of contradictions all the people in the top echelons of the Third Reich were. And I find it interesting as well how much drug use fit in with the idea in the Third Reich that we have to keep moving, everyone's going to stay awake, we're going to work really hard. Maybe just take us through a little bit, like, the state of drug use in the Weimar Republic and even just in pre-war Germany, maybe how readily available kind of nowadays crazy mad drugs would have been.
While researching the book, I try to find out where do all these famous drugs that we know today, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, come from. And they basically were all German products at one point in time. The Merck company had the patent on cocaine. The Bayer company developed heroin at the same time they developed aspirin. Germany in the late 19th century, without having same amount of colonies that, for example, Great Britain had or France had, but still being a large modern society with the need for stimulants, medications, and drugs, had to develop those stimulants on their own. And so the pharmaceutical industry in Germany plays an important role in developing these powerful substances and well, plays an important role in the developing German economy as a whole. So drug research, drug development became kind of a pillar of German society and a German economy. And that's the first chapter of the book. So I'm trying to to see where it all comes from.
Yeah. And you mention in the book the tablet Pervitin, and I found it really quite, well, striking and fascinating and also worrying just how, I suppose, would it be wrong to say that soldiers were dependent on it, or that kind of it certainly did contribute to their success in a big way, you could say?
Well, Pervitin, which contained methamphetamine, it's the first medication in the world that's basically made up of pure methamphetamine and was perfectly legal in Germany in 38 when it came onto the market. Became very popular among the civilian society. It was even mixed into chocolates for housewives,
yeah,
or for anybody who wanted to eat meth chocolate. You could just buy them in the shop. And then the German army examined whether methamphetamine could be useful for the war effort, because German universities had found out that methamphetamine keeps you from sleeping and reduces your fear and reduces your anxiety. So they made tests among medical officers and found that it might be a good drug for soldiers. And then before Germany attacked France, a stimulant decree was issued by the German army telling each medical officer how much Pervitin to issue once the attack would start. And 35 million dosages of Pervitin were being ordered by the Wehrmacht and shipped to the front lines, and contributed, if you believe my research, in quite a big way to the surprise victories of Germany in that campaign.
Mm. And I think it's very much an underrated aspect of it, because it's almost accepted that through Blitzkrieg the Germans just advanced and overran everything. But when you look at the nitty-gritty details, I mean, if a lot of them were taking this drug that basically enabled them to stay awake for extended periods of time, that really does give you, it gives you an artificial advantage. But the army's almost, quite literally, the army's almost on steroids, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it also deconstructs the myth of the unbeatable German Wehrmacht and the super soldier that was, the Nazi system was breeding. I mean, basically, the super soldier needed his extra portion of methamphetamine to, you know, turn into a soldier that was actually a little bit different than the Allied soldiers, who were drinking red wine and in order to boost themselves, which you cannot really compare to methamphetamine. The French soldiers were given 3/4 of a liter of red wine each day. That was the official drug consumption for the French army, and later on they made a report saying that this was counter-effective.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah. Basically, a bottle of red wine a day wouldn't exactly make you the most mobile or willing to go out there, kind of thing.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah, I mean, I want to just talk a little bit, because by and large, Blitzed has received a lot of favorable reviews, and I think rightfully so. I've read it twice, and I felt each time I read it when it first came out, and then I read it there recently to prepare for this. But I want to talk about one critique in particular, purely because if people see that criticism, they might not realize that. I'm talking about this review in The Guardian by a particular historian, Richard J. Evans. He goes through the fact, he claims that you underrate the actual responsibility of the Nazis and Hitler for their actions. Mm. And he also claims that because of this, you hint that the Nazis were somehow not to blame because they were under the influence. And he says that your book is morally and politically dangerous. Now, in my view, this is just him not properly reading the book or taking it the wrong way. But how would you respond to this criticism?
Well, I really think that he didn't read the book properly. I think he kind of glanced through it and he didn't like the whole approach. I'm certainly, I think the book, I mean, if we would put it in a political field, I think it's rather a leftist book, actually. It's certainly not a right-wing book that is trying to excuse the Nazis' crimes. And I state this in the book. I write about this question. I don't think at all that it diminishes the responsibility. I think he was, I don't know what's wrong with this guy. I mean, maybe... I'm invited to a conference in November where he's also invited, and I don't even know how I can communicate with him because he tried to, it's in a way he tried to launch a campaign against the book, and I just don't understand why he would do that. It would be interesting to, maybe it wouldn't be interesting, I don't know, to ask him why he did that. I mean, he's received a lot of publicity for trying to attack Blitz because Blitz has received a lot of publicity, so he's like against. He's like the one man standing against it. Maybe it makes him happy, or I don't know. I thought it was a bit strange, actually, because he also made a lot of factual mistakes in his review, saying that I would claim that Hitler was using methamphetamine, which Hitler, that's like the only drug Hitler didn't take. So he didn't read it very carefully, and I don't think he really thought about the book for long enough to actually make those statements that he made. I'm a little bit disappointed that The Guardian would print such garbage.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, newspapers these days, but by and large, I mean, the likes of Ian Kershaw, who wrote a big, big, thick biography of Hitler, it's on my shelf, and Anthony Beaver as well, who's written a whole load of books on the Second World War. Both of these historians allude to how important your research has been for giving us a different window in how the Third Reich worked and that kind of thing. How kind of... I suppose gratifying, like, does it make you feel proud to have these bona fide historians kind of saying that you've done a good job?
Well, of course. I mean, I was on the BBC Radio Life radio program with Anthony Beaver, and I had no idea, and my publisher had no idea how he would receive the book, and he enjoys it, so I was quite relieved, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, not more important, but very important from the start was the support by Ian Kershaw, who wrote a fantastic book on Hitler and knows everything about Hitler. And in Blitz, in a way, I criticize him, not strongly, but I kind of say, why didn't he write more about Morel? Why didn't he see there's a story here? So he reacted not like a small school child kind of being insulted or anything, but he kind of reacted with an open mind and... I think this book can only be appreciated by historians who are open-minded. And I didn't even think before I wrote it that there might be historians with closed minds. I thought they would all be, you know, very open-minded and think, yeah, this is interesting and we haven't thought about this. And I mean, you can obviously have critique, can criticize every book, and you could probably find things in Blitz that you could criticize, and that's totally... It's totally fine. I just think Evans, he didn't write a good criticism. It was a bit of a fast criticism that didn't really go into, you know, didn't really try to understand the book. So it was a bit unfortunate.
Yeah, but, and it's unfortunate as well because I'd hate the idea for someone to read that and think, oh, I'm not going to bother with this book kind of thing.
Probably that happened quite often.
I think that's why it's good that the likes of Ian Kershaw and Anthony Beaver have open minds. I think it is a mark of professionalism that you can say, okay, I overlooked that, but this guy has looked into it and I can see, like, just because I haven't thought of it doesn't mean it's not right, you know?
Well, that's the historians. It's a controversial book, so, I mean, it's an unusual book, so we shouldn't be too surprised that some historians it just rubs them the wrong way.
Sure. Yeah, that's so fair. I mean, everyone knows that the Second World War is like, you could call it occupied historical territory. I mean, we've already run through a few names of historians that have done a lot of work in that field. Were you kind of, Were you more careful, maybe? Were you, I mean, every historical book that has to be done has to take a lot of careful research, but did you have to, did you feel like you had to make sure your theories or your ideas were sound like extra watertight, if you like, just because you were aware that you'd be in this field with lots of people that have already done stuff?
Well, I mean, for me, it was very important to spend a lot of time in the archives and look at original documents. And I had always thought that this is a very natural habitat for the historian to do so. But I learned since that actually quite a few historians don't go to the archives or don't go anymore because they have a reputation now and they can just write the book staying at home and kind of reading other books and kind of putting their stuff together. So I think I did quite thorough research because I thought it was, you know, it's natural to spend like weeks and months in windowless archive rooms. And it's actually quite fun. I mean, it's, you know, it's time consuming and you have to travel and you have to get to the place and you have to find things. And it's not easy, but it's very interesting to actually have the documents, the original documents in your hands. But of course, it was difficult for me to write this book being a non-historian. So I thought to ask a German historian named Hans Mommsen. He passed away last year, but when I was writing the book, he was working with me on the book. He's a leading German historian on National Socialism, and I contacted him through my publisher, asking him whether he would be interested in that subject. And I mean, he's worked on this National Socialism his whole life, and when I came with all my photocopies from the archives into his study in south of Bavaria, south of Munich, he was very interested and was amazed by my findings. And then he actually discussed the structure of the book with me. And like it was his suggestion to also look at the German pharmaceutical industry and how it all came about. So I had a lot of help from this one particular historian, Hans Mommsen, who kind of helped me shape a book that could survive in the shark pool of historical nonfiction books.
Yeah, and you were saying there about he was amazed to see the sources. I mean, you even mentioned in your book that there's a lot of sources that have yet not even to be sorted through, but also even to be seen. I mean, there's boxes of stuff that are really badly categorized, and if not for archivists, really, it's a real toil to get through them.
Yeah, I mean, when the archives were indexed, for example, all this World War II stuff, when it was indexed in the 50s and 60s, no one thought about drug use. So if you go through the index, you can't, you know, you can't type into the computer drugs and it gives you all the documents having references to drug use. You have to, it's more complicated than that. So there might be, you know, more stuff out there, and I'm getting asked a lot when I have readings about the drug use of concentration camp guards and these Einsatzgruppen who did these mass shootings in
Of
Eastern
course,
Europe.
yeah.
And I have not found anything on them, but probably somewhere there's references. You know, maybe guys are writing home saying, "Only, you know, send me more heavy." I don't know. I'm sure there's stuff to be found, but I mean. So I hope that future historians will look at this question of how drugs shaped World War II or other wars. There was a review of my book in some British historian society where they basically said, hopefully now, this the good thing about the book is that it opens our eyes, the historians' eyes, to the question of drugs and how they might shape decision making. And so maybe there's more research that other people will do now.
Yeah, I mean, if you've gone there before, hopefully other people will be encouraged to go there again. Yeah, I want to talk as well. At one point, you mentioned being in the archive, and I just this kind of quote, it really stuck with me. You were talking to one of the archivists in Washington Archives, and he said that history always remains one thing: speculation drawing on the most relevant possible facts. And to me, that really captures so much of what history is. You take the facts that you can find that are at your hands, but I mean, we don't know what went on in people's minds. We don't know exactly what they were thinking at specific times. So, were you able to take some comfort from this kind of idea, knowing how much, like you said, how much stuff has yet to be seen?
Well, I do believe that the word story is in history for a reason, and I don't consider the historical sciences an accurate science. It is a science that borders, in German it's the Geisteswissenschaften, the sciences of the mind, which are not that precise and which leave room for interpretation.
Sure.
I guess the historian has to look at the sources and then, you know, with his conscience try to write a narrative that is as close, that is close to the truth. And but it's still a narrative. I consider it a fiction. I consider each historical nonfiction book also not a fiction book, but they all have fictional aspects, and probably some historical nonfiction writers would say it's not true. But if it would be true, then these books would be, I guess, too boring or too dry to read. I mean, every historical writer is also using his imagination in order to understand or connect the dots write something that makes sense to the readers. But one has to be very careful, of course, not to invent things that just obviously are not true. Or so I guess that's the art of historical nonfiction writing, to write in a vivid way without inventing unnecessary things. I try to really, I mean, in Blitzed, there's really nothing invented, but still, you know, I write about soldiers taking large amounts of methamphetamine before going into battle on the Western Front, and this is a fact. And another fact is that methamphetamine releases all the dopamine in the brain, and that the brain reacts in a certain way. So I'm trying to understand and describe how soldiers on methamphetamine, German soldiers invading France, how they feel and what's going on, the state of alertness that's going on in their brain. But obviously there's some fiction to it, you know, because it wasn't my brain that was reacting back then. It's not a first person account. And
sure.
I think that's kind of the art of writing this historical nonfiction genre.
Oh, definitely
it's certainly a big challenge. And I was, you know, trying to be as conscious about it as I could. Obviously, I'm a novelist, so I tend to invent things. So I had to kind of hold my horses back and stick to the documents that I found in the archives.
Yeah, and I mean, it is a fine line, but all history is like. But this isn't to say now by any means that speculation forms any large part of your book. I mean, one reviewer in particular called it a very like convincing book, and I mean, reading through all the personal accounts as well are what really got me. Like, we never really hear about people, about the soldiers writing home asking for more provision. Like, we don't hear about that at all. We like you hear about like the usual propaganda stuff that the soldiers wrote home. But I mean, it's hard to argue when you're presented with all of these accounts of different people saying different things about drugs and varying degrees of dependence. It really does strike you as something that really is quite, you build a strong picture, I think, around the idea that drugs were far more prevalent than we've really thought about before.
For sure.
I want to just move this discussion on from the Third Reich and Germany more to the person of Adolf Hitler himself. And you spend about half the book looking at Adolf Hitler himself, so it gives a really good a really good account of him from like the early days to the kind of the twilight era of the Third Reich, if you like. And you say at one point that any biography of Adolf Hitler, it has to take a detour through Theodor Morell, who was his personal doctor, physician. And why do you think that is?
First injection from this master of injections, which Morell was, that was his specialty as a doctor. From that moment on until 1945, late April 1945, Hitler spent more time with Morell than with any other human being. So not to examine the relationship, very intimate personal relationship between those two men, very strange relationship, because between them were the most potent drugs that mankind has ever manufactured, and they were pumped into Hitler's veins by Morell. So that, I mean, the exchange between the two men was quite, you know, unusual. And and the big Hitler biographies, we mentioned the one by Kershaw or the other one important one is by Joachim Fest, German historian. They do mention Morel because if you examine Hitler, you cannot miss Morel. He's always there. But they have not really examined what is going on between them. I mean, what medications, what drugs are actually being given, because they probably did not imagine that they could have an effect on Hitler's decision making. So this is what I was trying to examine and list.
Yeah. And do you think it would be fair to say that Morel has been largely forgotten or even overlooked as a kind of person around Hitler?
Yeah, for sure. Morel was an oddball in the headquarters. He was not one of these leading evil Nazi figures who committed horrific crimes. There's no statement of Morel. There's no anti-Semitic statement, for example, that exists of Morel. At least I didn't find one. Right. He didn't seem to be concerned with politics at all. He just completely played his role as the one person responsible for keeping the German head of state in good health. That was his job. That was what he thought he was doing. In fact, he was doing something quite different because he in a way, he ruined Hitler's health. He behaved very irresponsibly as a doctor. But in a way, he has a very small role, but at the same time, that role becomes very big because he does have a very powerful grip on Hitler's personality.
Yeah.
So Morel is, historians have overlooked him. They have looked at, all the other, there's quite a few important figures around Hitler, and each, deserves a 2,000-page biography, I suppose. So Morel is, no one had had time yet for Morel. I was the first one to spend some time with Morel, I guess.
You mentioned the weird relationship between Hitler and Morel. Maybe just run through some of the things that Morel was actually giving to Hitler.
Well, Morel was known as a Dr. Feelgood in Berlin in the early 30s. He had a very successful practice. He was famous for giving people injections of vitamins, but also stuff stronger than vitamins, hormone cocktails. And also he was very fond of giving Oikodal, which is a strong euphoric-making opioid, a half-synthetic opiate. What he gave Hitler was an amazing, always-changing cocktail of over 90 different medicines. And from 36 to 41, it actually is mostly vitamins and glucose and things that don't make you dependent. But in 41, he starts giving opiates for the first time to Hitler.
Mm.
And also he starts giving hormone injections, steroids, especially bull's testicle extracts, pig's liver extracts, thyroid glands extracts, weird stuff
that
is not really given anymore, but at the time it was kind of fashionable to give very potent hormone substances from animals in order to boost the immune system. He did that quite a lot from 41 to 43, and then 43 is really when Oikodal, the opioid, the half-synthetic opiate that makes you euphoric and is actually stronger than heroin, starts to come into the picture. And 44, he gives Hitler quite a lot of it. Every other day, Hitler receives 20 milligrams of Oikodal in the fall of 1944 and becomes physically dependent on the stuff. So the medication of Morel gets more and more intense and hard, and more and more hard drugs come into this cocktail.
Yeah, and a really interesting kind of parallel you mentioned, the way the worse things get for the military situation in Germany, and the more Hitler seems to kind of isolate himself in these different bunkers and military encampments and all that kind of thing, Hitler starts to kind of, maybe consciously or unconsciously, it's like he replaces the high of the adulation from the crowds that he used to get with this new chemical artificial high of all these drugs that are being pumped into.
Mm. Yeah, we can see that very clearly when we study Morel's notes. And when we study Hitler's appearances in public, there's a point when the war starts, and especially when the war against the Soviet Union starts, when he does not show himself in public anymore. So these big speeches basically stop. I mean, he has some big speeches in front of military military gatherings, but he does not get this standing ovations like he did before, which were kind of feeding into his charisma and into his personality. And but
sure.
he's now using especially Oikodal to boost his self confidence, kind of artificially replacing the natural stimulus that he was getting from the crowds.
Yeah, you mentioned as well, like at certain points he seems like disheveled and like people are shocked by his appearance, and 9 times out of 10 an injection of this stuff brings him back to life almost. But then there's the odd time as well where the likes of Goebbels or someone else around him would even write down themselves for like in their own diary that Hitler doesn't seem to look well, or they're worried even about Morel's kind of what Morel might be doing to him. I think that kind of stuff is fascinating, and the impact that all of this must have had on Hitler's psyche, how it must have eroded his health by the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler looked younger than he was for quite some time. There's one description that he looked younger than he was till 39, and from 39 to 41 he looked his age, and then 41 he really started aging, and we can see that in that period Morel's hormone injections, these steroids, are being administered quite often. So I guess these quick fixes didn't really pay off in the long run. I mean, Hitler's health really degenerated without him being sick. He didn't have an illness. I mean, there's rumors that towards the end he had Parkinson's, but there's no proof for it. It's just a way to explain his deteriorating health and the tremor that was developing. If we look at what Morel was giving him, the amounts of opiates that he received in 43, especially 44, that might be another explanation for his deteriorating health and the tremor that he developed, especially in the first weeks and months of 1945, when suddenly Morel doesn't have these drugs available anymore, apparently because the British had bombed all the pharmaceutical companies by then and supplies were running out in Germany.
Yeah, you mentioned as well that the way that Morel kind of, because there was a few, well, there was one notable kind of struggle for power against Morel. And after that had failed and Morel held on to his position, he was kind of explaining himself to Hitler how, because of his treatment, because of the injections, Hitler was able to kind of get back to work kind of straight away, because there just wasn't time to do the kind of normal procedures. And Hitler even said that, yes, his Morel's methods might be kind of like unusual and they might not necessarily have been proven, but they're necessary for the situation that we're in now.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of suspicion against Morel in the inner circles. Himmler was very suspicious. Bormann hated Morel because Morel was closer to Hitler than himself. The two men never disclosed what was given. It was an unusual situation for sure within the headquarters, that there was stuff going on that no one knew about. When Morel writes in his notes, when he records that conversation with Hitler, that he had to always go to the extreme and give very high dosages in order to restore Hitler to proper health, keep him functioning even in difficult times. I mean, that really is telling of what was going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to talk as well about, like, it wasn't just Hitler. After a while, people started to think, when they were around Hitler, they started to think, oh, Hitler seems to be doing well. He seems to be getting, like, regularly pepped up. Maybe I'll try this stuff too. And then you mentioned some of the stuff, like, I think the one that really sticks out to me, Leni Riefenstahl, the famous filmmaker and everything else, she was taking morphine enemas.
Yeah, well, Morel became very fashionable because he had the most powerful patient in the Reich. So know, it was, if you want to be close to Hitler, it was good to be also a patient of Morel. Also Goebbels received injections from Morel. Speer did. Leni Riefenstahl received these medications, these opium medications. Morel became a very busy man. There's one passage in his notes where he complains that he has no more free time and that he's running around from one famous patient to the next. And but you can also read between the lines that he's extremely proud of the influence, and he thinks he's making history with the syringe, basically.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, really. And I think by way of his importance, people start to get almost used to it, used to his kind of regular injections, if you like. And because of that, they don't really realize. There's a great few sentences you write where the Hitler the vegetarian takes an injection after eating this perfect meal at dinner time. I think it was around his birthday, his 55th birthday. After eating this perfect meal with no meat to speak of, he then takes an injection made up of the organs of slaughtered animals. Like, yeah, it's madness.
Really, it is pretty mad. Yeah.
What kind of runs through your head when you're reading this stuff for like the first time?
Well, I mean, for me as a writer, I felt joy for, you know, reading those documents, and just because I realized this is like the craziest story in the world, or at least that's how I felt. So it was very interesting material to work with, and to try to figure out how to compose this book was a lot of fun also, even though it was also dark, obviously, because it's concerned with these dark people.
Sure.
Doing these dark things, but you know, the drug angle always, you know, lets you laugh a bit sometimes, or lets you, you know, it's for me, it was a healthy angle to write a story about the Third Reich.
And I think continuing with the theme of Hitler's contradictory kind of behavior, there's that kind of key moment after Operation Valkyrie where the assassination attempt on him fails on July the 20th, 1944. And from that point, he really seems to go downhill, even just the psychological impact of all of his peers kind of turning on him in such a way. But this new doctor enters the picture, an ear and nose doctor, and he starts to give him kind of cocaine swabs of all things. And there's this great line where Hitler says he doesn't want to be a cocaine addict, and his new doctor says you can't be an addict unless you're only those that snort cocaine are addicts. And I just thought that was a hilarious way to kind of write off exactly what was happening. Like,
well, that report from Dr. Giesing is stored in the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, and this was one of the first things I read, and I really thought this is, because it's written, it has a lot of detail. Like, he actually describes how Hitler takes these cocaine swabs, or how the cocaine was brought into the headquarters. How did it actually technically work to get this cocaine in there officially and then administer it to Hitler, and how Hitler reacted, and how then Morel reacted. He was very jealous that this new doctor has this new powerful drug, and then Giesing was actually trying to have Morel removed and take on his position. So that's this kind of doctor's war that I described that had took place in September and October 1944. Kind of a war between cocaine and oikodal, the opiate. So that's certainly the most crazy period of the whole Hitler's drug taking.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting the way there was a power struggle. Like, in late 1944, we kind of think as the Nazi regime is pretty much on the death throes, and yet there are these, what I like to think of as the rats fighting over the helm of a sinking ship. Like, it's madness to think that they would fight so enthusiastically to be in a position which surely they know can't last much longer.
Yeah, I was also surprised by that. And in the way, the doctor's war was a proxy war for the succession of Hitler, because they knew that if they can remove Morel, then Hitler will basically fall apart. So they were behind these doctors that were trying to remove Morel. They were the people who were trying to take Hitler's position. There was Speer, there was Himmler and Bormann. So they were really fighting for becoming the next German Führer, and I had never really studied that that aspect before. And actually studying the drug situation in the Third Reich led me to, you know, study all kinds of aspects of that era. That was quite fascinating. And I think that hopefully that shows in Blitz that if you read Blitz, you're not going to read just a story on drugs in the Third Reich, but you're basically going to read the whole story of the Third Reich from this angle. But it touches so many aspects.
Yeah.
That you don't need Richard Evans' books anymore.
I like it. It's very good. I really want to thank you very much for coming on to the show. And it, just to conclude, I think it'd be good to say, if people wanted to find you, if they wanted to find your book, I mean, I was very excited because you're the first kind of not only international best-selling author that I've had, but the first guy whose book I found just in the bookstore, in just around the corner from myself. So it's very exciting to have you on. And if people, do you have a website? Are you on social media?
Yeah, you can find me at normanoller.com, or you can find me on Facebook and also on Twitter. And hopefully the book's in a local bookshop. And that's always the best way to buy them.
Yeah, well, I found this one in Greystones in County Wicklow. So I'd imagine if it's there, good. Then...
That's everyone.
Probably be most places.
Great. So no, it was a pleasure to be on the show.
Thanks very much for coming on, Norman, and I'm sure I'll talk to you soon.
That'd be great. Thank you.
All right. What did we think of that? I, for one, enjoyed myself, and I am happy to say Norman Oler was, well, really quite generous, quite patient with me as well, and really took all my questions on board and gave me proper answers. Objectively speaking, you might say that he sounds a bit tired, and yes, I think that's fair enough. He's probably doing an awful lot of talking about the book, but he didn't skimp on the details with this conversation here. So I hope you did enjoy it. Make sure to let me know through the usual channels what you thought. And if this is your first time listening to When Diplomacy Fails, we do new episodes every single week and sometimes twice a week. So if you're interested in history, if you're a history nerd like myself, make sure and check us out. Go to wdfpodcast.com or simply search for When Diplomacy Fails in your favorite podcatcher. That's the episode, guys. I'm 26 years old now and things are very, very old. But hey, we're still doing this. We're still making history thrive. This has been Zach. Collaboration episode, Norman Oler. Go and tell your friends. But until then, I'll be seeing you all soon.